Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. We hope all of you had a happy Thanksgiving weekend, and perhaps now is a good time to reflect on the plight of those who are less fortunate and who don't have a home in which to share the holiday season with their loved ones. San Diego now has the nation's fourth highest rate of homelessness, a new federal report reveals. We'll tell you how our city, county, and state compare to the national average, including some areas that are improving, though we still have a long way to go. At San Diego State University, Muslim students held a rally last week to protest a hate crime on campus, and we'll have details. Winter weather is here as we usher in December, and we'll have details about a frost advisory issued for our region. We'll also have news about a new law to protect military dogs and make sure that when their service is over, they're guaranteed a safe home along with our soldiers. A man who spent 16 years behind bars has had his conviction overturned thanks to DNA evidence found with help from Project Innocence, a program started at a local law school right here in San Diego. But despite being cleared, his freedom is not secured, and we'll tell you why. Also on today's show, hear about a tuberculosis case at an East County high school and about a courageous El Cajon man who risked his life to save his neighbor's pets during a fire. On Tribal Beat, hear about a film premiere coming up in San Diego about Native American women. A dozen people have fallen ill, some seriously, over the weekend due to a batch of a synthetic drug known as spice. Find out more on today's show. San Diego Gas and Electric Company is taking an unusual step to fight community choice in where you purchase your electricity. We'll have a special report on this from Public News Service. Then from the County of San Diego, learn about a new infestation of beetles that is threatening many species of trees locally and how you can help prevent its spread. From Public News Service, we'll have an update on the stories that are making headlines nationally, including a shooting at an abortion clinic in Colorado and police violence in Chicago. Our newsmaker interview today is with Jeffrey McElwain, a San Diego State University professor who teaches a course in emergency preparedness. Last week, we spoke with Dr. McElwain on terrorism issues. Today, in part two of our interview, he'll be talking about risks ranging from wildfires to contagious diseases and what you should know to prepare for the unexpected before an emergency strikes. We'll also have news about a special Christmas benefit event being hosted by St. Michael's Chaldean Church in El Cajon, where the proceeds will benefit local families, including refugees in need this holiday season. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. The San Diego City and County region now has the fourth largest homeless population in the United States, and almost half of those are sleeping on the streets or camping along riverbeds or other outdoor places with no shelter from the elements. Only New York City, Los Angeles, and Seattle have more homeless people than our county. Those are the findings of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's Homeless Assessment Report, which found San Diego's homeless population rose 2.8% over the last year to a total of 8,742 homeless people here in 2015. That's far worse than the national average. Nationwide, over a half million people were homeless as of January when the annual count was done, but 69% of the nation's homeless were in shelters. California has 21% of the nation's homeless population, and while the number has dropped some in recent years, our state still has the highest rate of unsheltered homeless people in the nation at 64%. With an El Nino forecast to bring one of the harshest winters in recent memory, that means many are at risk living outdoors in wet, cold weather with potential flooding adding to their miseries. Nationally, however, some progress has been made. Across the U.S., homelessness dropped 2% last year and 11% since 2007. The percentage of those who are chronically homeless, as opposed to just temporarily, has fallen 31% from 2010 to 2015 nationally, and homelessness among veterans has fallen 36%, thanks to more supportive programs to help them. But in California, most, 62%, of homeless veterans still have no shelter, and that's the second worst rate in the nation, after Montana. Still, the overall number of homeless vets in California has fallen sharply, over 37%, in the last 6 years. San Diego has 1,381 homeless veterans as of the January survey. Nationwide, over a third of all homeless people are families, 36% of them, and 23% of all homeless people are children under age 18. In San Diego, 625 of the homeless here are unaccompanied minors. San Diego also has the nation's fifth highest rate of chronically homeless individuals, over 1,500 of them. San Diego's high cost of housing and living for everything from utility bills to gasoline are key factors in the region's high homelessness rate. The San Diego Housing Commission has launched some programs to reduce homelessness locally, including affordable housing and federal housing vouchers for those suffering economic displacement. Other programs offer treatment for drug abuse and mental illness, conditions that contribute to homelessness, or target homeless veterans. But as the numbers in this year's survey show, our region still has a long way to go to meet the needs of homeless people across our region. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
In response to an assault on a Muslim woman at San Diego State University last week, the Muslim Student Association held a rally on campus Monday. Students are urging witnesses to come forward to help police find the man who ripped a headscarf off a young woman student, pushing her and using racial slurs last Thursday as she was walking on campus. The woman was not injured. However, the assault is being investigated as a hate crime. Campus police describe the suspect as a white man in his 20s, thin with black hair and green or hazel eyes, about 5'11" tall. The Muslim Student Association is calling for a zero tolerance policy towards what it calls Islamophobic rhetoric and actions on campus. The group also wants mandatory training for faculty, staff, and students, plus coursework on Islam to foster, in the students' words, a more inclusive climate by promoting tolerance and acceptance between different cultures and religions. The Council on American-Islamic Relations in San Diego issued a statement indicating the attack on the Muslim woman at SDSU could be related to a backlash against the American Muslim community since the recent terror attacks in Paris. The Islamic State, or ISIS, has claimed credit for the brutal attacks on a theater, stadium, and restaurants in Paris. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a weather report. The National Weather Service has issued a frost advisory for chilly weather set to continue Monday night and Tuesday morning, with morning low temperatures in the 20s and 30s and frost likely across much of our inland region. Be sure to cover any cold-sensitive plants, and please bring your pets inside to keep them safe.
Military dogs will be guaranteed a safe return home and retirement in the United States after their service is completed, thanks to a provision in the National Defense Authorization Act, signed into law by President Barack Obama. Their military handlers, who served alongside these canine heroes, will be given the first rights to adopt them, says Dr. Robin Ganzert, president of the American Humane Association, which fought for the legislation to protect these dogs. Dogs have been used in the U.S. military since the Civil War, when they guarded soldiers. In World War I, thousands of dogs were used as couriers, and in World War II, Marines used dogs to locate enemy positions. Dogs led jungle patrols in Vietnam and helped detect bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan, sometimes losing their own lives, but saving many others. Today, it's been estimated that each military working dog saves the lives of 150 to 200 service members. That's because dogs' sense of smell is 100,000 times more sensitive than people, enabling them to sniff out explosives and locate weapons caches. Dogs also provide companionship to troops far away from home. Before Vietnam, dogs were brought home after their service ended, but during the Vietnam War, dogs were classified as expendable equipment. Many were euthanized or left behind by the military when our soldiers came home. In 2000, President Clinton signed Robbie's Law to enable warrior dogs to be adopted after their military service was over. But the 2014 National Defense Authorization Act had a clause that made it optional for the military to transfer retired dogs back to the U.S., so once again, many were abandoned overseas. That same year, the American Humane Association paid for the transportation home of 21 military dogs, helping to reunite them with their former handlers. The association began lobbying Congress, fighting to allow all military dogs to come home. Finally, the 2016 measure passed with bipartisan support and was signed into law by President Barack Obama. Ganzert voiced gratitude that every service dog will now finally get the retirement they deserve with those who care for them the most. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
A Superior Court judge in Los Angeles has ordered the conviction of Luis Vargas overturned after DNA evidence proved that he spent 16 years in prison for a series of rapes that he did not commit. The California Innocence Project at California Western School of Law, right here in San Diego, requested the DNA testing of evidence from crime scenes that were never tested before. Vargas had been convicted of three rapes solely on eyewitnesses based on a teardrop-shaped tattoo under his eye. But the DNA evidence proves that the rapes were actually committed not by Vargas, but by the teardrop rapist, a man responsible for at least 35 rapes in Los Angeles over the last three decades. The teardrop rapist has never been caught and is on the FBI's most wanted list. On the day of his sentencing, Vargas told the court he was concerned that the real criminal remained at large and could rape or even kill more victims. He later sent Project Innocence a letter about the teardrop rapist and suggested the project seek DNA testing of any remaining biological material. Raquel Cohen, staff attorney of the California Innocence Project, praised the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office for agreeing to examine the case and join in the petition to reverse the conviction after two other jurisdictions refused to cooperate. Cohen added, this is how cases should be resolved. Upon his exoneration, Vargas, now 46 years old, burst into tears of joy in the courtroom. But his troubles are not over. Although cleared of the crimes for which he was imprisoned, Vargas has an immigration hold from an incident years earlier, and he remains in custody. Project Innocence has indicated it hopes for a speedy release so that Vargas can spend the holidays with his loved ones finally. But the specter of deportation continues to haunt him as he remains behind bars. Students and faculty at Cal Western School of Law donate over 20,000 hours of their time each year to community projects, including the California Innocence Project, which receives about 1,500 claims from inmates every year and has freed 20 wrongfully convicted clients since its inception. You can read more at CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org. For East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with a health report from the County of San Diego. A case of tuberculosis has been diagnosed in a person at Helix Charter High School in La Mesa, the County Health and Human Services Agency reports. The county is working with school officials to notify anyone who was possibly exposed to the disease between August 5th and November 13th. Free testing for students who may have been exposed will take place on December 1st at the school. Symptoms of active TB include persistent cough, fever, night sweats, and unexplained weight loss. Most people who are exposed to TB do not develop the disease, but those that do develop symptoms that can be treated and cured with medication, says Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county public health officer. So far, 184 cases of TB have been reported this year in the San Diego region. For more information on this potential exposure, you can call a county TB control program at 619-692-8621.
A fire at an El Cajon home could have been far more tragic if not for the courage of a neighbor. When Anthony Menchaca spotted an orange glow shortly after midnight last Tuesday, he ran outside and saw flames engulfing the studio apartment. Knowing his neighbor was at work and had pets inside, he broke a window and risked his life to save four dogs and two cats from the fire. Fortunately, he was not injured and managed to rescue all the animals. Firefighters doused the blaze, which may have started in the kitchen. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with a Tribal Beat Report. Hamul Indian Village Chairwoman Erica Pinto and council members invites you to the complimentary premiere showing of 1,000 Voices, a documentary of Native American women from the beginning of time. The film will premiere on Monday, December 14th at 11 a.m. at the Kroc Center, located on 6611 University Avenue in San Diego. From the proverb, it takes 1,000 voices to tell a single story, this is a documentary that builds from thousands of voices to present one universal story of New Mexico's Native American women. Native American women have been purveyors of culture since creation. In spite of Western invasions, Native American women remain strong and grounded in traditional values by enduring courage and wisdom. The voices and advisors represent 16 different Native American nations in the Southwest region. If you would like to attend this free film premiere, please RSVP to Liza Kumper by calling 619-669-4855 or email her at lkumper@hamulindianvillage.com.
Groups concerned about climate change are mobilizing to fight one of the state's three biggest power companies. The issue is known as Community Choice Energy, a movement by cities to create nonprofit agencies to buy and sell power to consumers. San Diego Gas and Electric just announced it is forming a separate marketing entity to lobby against the idea, since by law it can't use ratepayer money for that purpose. Nicole Kapritz with the Climate Action Campaign says in the past, the utility claimed to be neutral on community choice.
They just proved that they're not neutral at all. They talk out of both sides of their mouth. So on the one hand, they say, oh, we support the climate plan. On the other hand, they're lobbying against it and trying to take away the right of local governments to take control over their energy future.
In California, community choice electric providers can set the rates and decide where to buy the power, while the utility company still gets a fee for maintaining the grid. San Francisco starts up its new community choice agency January 1st. Pete Hassopoulos with the Sierra Club says the system is already in place in the city of Lancaster and in Sonoma and Marin counties.
Where they're doing it in the other parts of California, they're delivering more clean energy and even beating the monopolies on rates.
He says community choice providers are also encouraging more rooftop solar, while the state's major utilities have asked the Public Utilities Commission to cut the rates they have to pay people who generate more power than they use. Meanwhile, the city of San Diego has budgeted money for a feasibility study, which should be done by next fall. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Synthetic marijuana known as spice is being blamed for making a dozen people fall ill downtown near Petco Park over the weekend, according to San Diego police, including two patients who were hospitalized. Symptoms range from vomiting to unconsciousness. Spice is marketed by drug dealers as synthetic marijuana, but it actually causes far more serious medical problems than marijuana, and California banned sale of spice, along with other synthetic cannabinoid compounds, back in 2012. Two arrests have been made in connection with the bad batch of spice, which sickened victims as young as age 13. Anyone with information on the source of this tainted drug is asked to contact San Diego police.
When it comes to wood borers, this one always gets the most press. The gold-spotted oak borer is causing massive die-offs in our local woodlands, infesting and killing decades-old stands of oak trees.
What we have here is a bunch of different types of wood that have been attacked by different boring beetles.
But while the gold-spotted borer, or GSOB for short, is an imported aggressive pest, county entomologist Tracy Ellis reminds us that it's not the only species out there.
These types of borers attack trees that are already dead and dying from other conditions, and it's part of the normal decay process.
So if you had wood dotted with these tiny holes, it used to hold true that oak was the only firewood you needed to be concerned about when it came to spreading a bad borer. But with firewood season upon us, there's another borer with a much wider diet that could be lurking in that freshly cut pile of wood. It's called a polyphagous shothole borer, and it's hungry.
One of the reasons that the new one, the polyphagous shothole borer, is confusing to people is because it looks so much like other shot hole borers in a whole bunch of different types of trees, and it affects a whole bunch of different types of trees, about 10 different families of trees.
Oak trees, coral trees, red maples, plums, even avocados. This map shows the Southland's avocado groves in green. The blue and red triangles mark confirmed infestations of the borer. The concern for avocado farmers is that a rogue load of firewood could spread the pest further across the state.
The prepackaged wood that's wrapped and bundled and labeled at your grocery store or your drugstore is fine. You can tell that wood has been dried and cured, and there's no living larvae in that wood.
Dry, seasoned wood, or wood that has been chipped into mulch, those are the only ways to be sure an infested tree has been rid of the pest. So if you have a tree on your property that has the telltale markings of a borer, it would be wise to visit one of two websites, gsob.org or pshb.org.
They can make reports on what symptoms they're having and make contact with an expert who can help them diagnose what kind of pests they have. And if it's a pest that's of concern, where they would need to dispose of it carefully.
Whether it's your own wood or firewood purchased in bulk from a supplier, the concern about the threat to California's farms and forests is great enough to warrant its own website. To learn more about the Buy It Where You Burn It campaign, visit firewood.ca.gov. In the County News Center, I'm Dominic Fulgoni.
Welcome to the Public News Service. I'm Brandon Campbell. We've got several topics on tap from around the country this weekend, including several people were killed during a shooting at a Planned Parenthood center in Colorado. The protests over a police shooting continue in Chicago. And now that we're in full holiday mode, new research suggests that family time matters most to developing children. Now, more on our top story. A shooting Friday morning inside a Planned Parenthood office in Colorado Springs left several people dead, including at least one officer. Colorado police say at least 11 people were shot, with most surviving their wounds. The suspected gunman was caught by police hours later. They say he was wearing hunting gear and armed with what they described as a long gun. Witnesses told the Associated Press they heard automatic gunfire coming from the building before police arrived. So far, police haven't said if there was a motive for the attack. However, Planned Parenthood facilities have been targeted for political or ideological reasons in the past. Vicky Cowart, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood in the Rocky Mountains region, said in a written statement that she's concerned that, quote, extremists are creating a poisonous environment that feeds domestic terrorism in this country. Let's turn now to Chicago, where protesters shut down Black Friday shopping in one of the country's most iconic retail districts, the Magnificent Mile. The Washington Post reports that Friday's demonstration was the largest since police released a video of a white Chicago officer shooting and killing a black teenager in October of last year. Officer Jason Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder in the killing of Laquan McDonald. Protesters called for Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy to resign, and they chanted 16 shots, a reference to how many times Van Dyke allegedly fired his gun at McDonald. Protesters are also demanding a federal investigator look into the Chicago Police Department. And as we approach the official start of winter, homeless shelters across the country are preparing for what is typically their busiest time of year. But for some states, the issue is bigger than in others. New numbers show California topping the list as the worst state in the nation for taking care of its homeless population. Almost two-thirds are sleeping outside with no shelter, according to a new report from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. Suzanne Potter has the story.
The annual report takes a snapshot in time, in this case, one night in January of this year. Researchers found that California has 21% of the country's homeless population, or almost 116,000 people. Jennifer Friedenbach with the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco says Sacramento has paid zero attention to the problem.
We have very little investment by the state in this issue. They fund a very tiny amount of money towards emergency shelter. Our primary funding for housing, at least in San Francisco, was through redevelopment, which was eliminated.
Across the country, the number of individuals experiencing chronic homelessness declined by 31%, or almost 23,000 people, between 2010 and 2015. Friedenbach attributes that to a big federal push after the recession to find housing for homeless families with children.
The study also found that the lion's share of California's homeless are in Los Angeles County, which has more than three times the homeless population of the Bay Area. And in New York, a state agency is raising concerns for prosecuting a very small number of the cases it receives. At issue is the Justice Center for the Protection of People with Special Needs, which was created to ensure the health and safety of New Yorkers with disabilities. Nia Hamm reports.
An Associated Press report reveals that, of more than 25,000 claims of abuse and neglect the center has received since the start of 2014, just 169 have led to criminal charges. Experts say cases like these can be hard to prove, in part because they often rely on victims with disabilities who are viewed as poor witnesses. Susan Dua with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York says a shift in this thinking could lead to more prosecutions.
There is no reason to believe that people with disabilities have a diminished ability to report accurately about their experiences of being abused.
A Justice Center spokesperson says it's currently training with local law enforcement and prosecutors on forensic interviewing best practices with vulnerable populations, including people with disabilities. The report also finds that of the 132 allegations involving deaths, the center has only prosecuted one.
The Justice Center also says it reviews all allegations of abuse, and when evidence supports those allegations, it holds people accountable. Other New Yorkers are also facing some problems, as a new report says millions of people in the state are being ripped off every day by companies that cheat them out of wages and other benefits they should be earning. More on that from Mike Clifford.
Kate Hamaji is a researcher at the Center for Popular Democracy, which issued the report. She says they found companies are cheating workers by a variety of methods, including failing to pay minimum wage or overtime, denying benefits, making illegal deductions, and even telling them to work off the clock.
We estimated that 2.1 million New Yorkers are victims of wage theft annually and cheated out of a cumulative $3.2 billion in wages and benefits that they are owed.
The report, By a Thousand Cuts, The Complex Face of Wage Theft in New York, identified 11 companies they call bad actors who they say engage in particularly egregious behavior.
And finally, now that Thanksgiving's over, we're officially into the holiday season, and family research experts are recommending that parents pay special attention to the time they spend with their kids. That idea is being explored by a new report which underlines the importance of family time on child development. Stephanie Carson explains.
Researchers found it has more of an impact than other demographic factors such as race and income. Parenting expert Peggy O'Meara says it confirms basic principles of how humans develop.
We really learn by mimicking and by modeling rather than by being told what to do. So when parents interact with their children, they show interest in them, when they help them realize their potential, the children do that themselves with their families and with themselves when they grow up.
The report recommends parents take 5 essential actions to foster development, including expressing care of the child, encourage personal growth, provide support, share in decision-making, and connecting a child to opportunities.
And that's our weekend update. I'm Brandon Campbell for Public News Service, member and listener-supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part 2 of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. We are back today with Professor Jeffrey McElwain, who is an expert on many different areas. He wears a number of hats. Last week, we talked to him about his expertise in international terrorism and geopolitics globally. And today, we're going to be talking about his expertise in disaster response. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us briefly a little bit about your background in disaster response. I know that you've worked for the Red Cross, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I've been involved with for a long time. I started for the first time volunteering and for a member of the Red Cross past, actually, the disaster that took the life of my mom, which was the mid-air collision that occurred in Cerritos in 1986.
Yeah, horrifying.
And I was brought up to serve others, and I knew my mom would have, you know, probably had a few words with me if I was sitting around, you know, not helping others at a time of need. And so that being close to my heart, I went on to volunteer for various chapters of the Red Cross in Los Angeles area, but also in Ohio, Pennsylvania, in Sonoma, Mendocino counties, where I lived for a while, eventually becoming a board member for the Red Cross in Sonoma and that area. And then also I'd spent a year working as a civilian employee for LA County Emergency Management, where I worked on everything from all these major federal grants that help local governments and, you know, planning emergency management exercises and doing community disaster education things. So, so, and then over the years, just through San Diego State, being involved with a lot of research projects as we apply science and technology to help those that are in need.
Yeah, sometimes people worry a lot about what's in the headlines today. You know, this week it's terrorism, but they don't pay enough attention to risks that are probably much more likely to befall them, like a wildfire or a flood or, you know, burglary where you get all your data stolen on your computer, or a fire that burns your dormitory down on campus. In the San Diego region, what are some of the top risks that people should really be most focused on?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you start with something like this, you just have to look at the natural world, and you have to look at the fact that, yes, we're in a place that's going to be very prone to flooding. The water just cannot be absorbed here. A lot of us live in areas where it's, you know, sand versus, you know, bedrock. That
El Nino is only going to make that worse.
El Nino, yes. And then we also have, of course, the issues related to wildfires. You know, as we build outwards and we move and we become part of nature and what it provides, we are subject to the various droughts and the winds and other things that can make wildfires so incredibly dangerous. And then, of course, you know, obviously the earthquakes as well. We don't have a major fault, so to speak, that we know of that runs through here. We will, of course, suffer any effects of any of the major faults that occur going on throughout our state. But at the same point, we also have built in many areas with soft soils where liquefaction can occur and other things.
That, like the wind turbines they built on top of the earthquake fault out there in Ocotillo, for instance, which is an area known for liquefaction. Yeah. It has a quake fault capable of a 7.0 quake, they say.
I had the privilege, I guess, of having a team of graduate students that went to Mexicali after that earthquake. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though only less than 8 people were killed in this quake, I think it was 8 people total.
Yeah, but 25,000 left homeless in Mexico alone.
Yeah, but when you look at what it did, for example, to the agricultural infrastructure, it was just horrendous in terms of salinization of the lands, in terms of changing the water levels in terms of irrigation, busting the irrigation canals. So we can have a disaster that is not making the headlines in terms of loss of life, or something that The Rock would go and, you know, tackle like in San Andreas, but it can have massive long-term economic impact in a community. So,
what about tsunamis?
Yeah, that's the other thing too, is that if you guys go online and look at tsunami risk for San Diego area, we know historically that San Diego has had its share of tsunamis that have hit.
Really? How severe?
Major earthquake, for example, up in Alaska could send a tsunami down to this area. We did a major exercise for this about 10 years ago at San Diego State, an international exercise.
We're talking a tsunami the equivalent of what we saw in Japan or Southeast Asia, or something much smaller?
I can't remember the actual concrete nature. I think it was 7 to 8 foot.
That's pretty
big. But basically, when you're talking about places like Coronado and you're talking about the oceanfront areas, but also the wetlands and other areas as we go up to North County.
And the nuclear waste is stored at San Onofre.
And so, so when we look at these different areas, there's different places that have different risk. Krakatoa volcano, for example, sent a tsunami that hit what's now Pacific Beach. It actually caused a real estate collapse because they were looking to sell the lots in Pacific Beach.
Wow.
And that tsunami hit in that area, what is now Pacific Beach. And if you do it. By the way, if you're ever doing a drunk crawl on Pacific Beach one day, when you look up off the pavement, you'll see these tsunami evacuation signs pointing in different directions. So the authorities are aware of the possibility.
Well, it's like a lot of people aren't aware that around 1970 or so, we had Hurricane Kathleen that tore through East County. It actually ripped apart Interstate 8 and the rail line, and it sent a 10-foot wall of water across Ocotillo out in Imperial County, did an awful lot of damage.
Yep.
And who knew that we could be in a hurricane area here?
Yeah, exactly.
So that said, what are some of the basic common sense things that everybody should do to be prepared for an emergency. What's on your top 10 list there?
You know, I think it's just creating a culture of resiliency. I think that when you think along the lines of, I always tell my students, stop and think. If you can't get back home right now or get to your car, what do you have on you?
Yeah.
Well, I have ATM cards. Well, what if the ATM doesn't work? We all realize very quickly how much our life falls apart if we can't go to Starbucks and buy, you know, buy some coffee.
So have cash stashed in your car.
You well, you know, but the idea being that we need to create lives that we have resiliency. We need to basically understand that we can't take for granted the fact that the things that we do for our food, our water, our electricity and other things, that they're going to be available at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Many different things can interrupt that. What I suggest to people is that, you know, and one thing that's close to my heart was if you were to ask me, Jeff, you know, your house was destroyed by this plane crash and your mom was killed in this, you know, what's the one thing besides your mom that you wish you could have saved? And honestly, for me, I mean, I had autographed baseballs from Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale and all these things that are valuable and all the stuff that were given to me as a kid.
Yeah.
And those don't matter to me. What mattered to me most was photographs. And this was before digital photography. So, you know, for many people, especially people that may not be as attuned to such things, the idea of storing photographs or scanning old photographs and putting it up on the cloud or putting it somewhere else where it's not in a certain physical location where they can be destroyed, trust me, you will thank me later. I expect you to send me a nice thank you card, God forbid, if anything happens. That's the one thing that you'll miss the most.
And really, listeners, I would say redundancy on protecting your most important data. Interestingly,
and documents too. Yeah, your insurance documents, things along those lines.
Well, in the last week alone, I know three different people who've completely lost everything on their computer. One of them had a burglary. The other two had catastrophic crashes. One said, I thought I was totally protected. It was all up in the cloud, but somehow that got corrupted. The other one had backed everything up to an extra hard drive, and there was something wrong with that, too. So all three of them lost everything. So it seems like, I know I'm very paranoid about this, I back up on the cloud, I back up on a spare hard drive, and really it's a good idea with something like photos to actually put some of them on a CD and go stick it in a safe deposit box or leave them with a relative who doesn't live in the area or someplace. So you have multiple ways that you can restore and rebuild if there is something catastrophic.
And important documents too, like insurance documents, bank accounts, I mean, things like that. These are the things you don't want to be thinking about having. We had to fill out a form for disaster relief. You know, they're going to ask you for this information, and having it available is good. One thing I want to add right here, and the one thing that I think is very important for us to realize, we can take advantage of the fact that lots of really good, hardworking people have put a lot of effort in trying to help us create that sense of resiliency and maintain it. The first stop that I would have people go to is our County Office of Emergency Services. They have a wonderful website online. On that website, you can find all sorts of things. If you're interested, for example, how does your address fit in terms of fire issues, and how does it deal with in terms of possibility of flooding? All that information can be taken off that sort of website, the various reports and other services it offers. It also offers something that's very convenient, which is an app that you can download to your phone.
Oh.
And what's nice about this app is that you can set it to give you alerts. So one thing that we think of is when we think about emergency preparedness and things, we think about maybe our home and our business. But we don't spend our whole lives in those places.
No.
You know, I take my kids, we're playing football with Pop Warner up in Santee or in Lakeside, or we're going, you know, we're doing things like that.
So you want to get it on your cell phone.
And what happens is if there's a disaster or there's something that's imminent in that area, we know through the data location on cell phones to push information for people in that area.
Oh, very nice.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, and it keeps track. And by the way, this is done commonly in other countries like Indonesia and other areas where their whole world revolves around smartphones in ways that even we haven't embraced.
Yeah, and the county has its own tell people where they can sign up for that app.
You can go to the County Office of Emergency Services website and San Diego County Emergency Services and just explore the website. There's everything. They have checklists. What are the things you have in your car? What are the things you have in your home? What are the things you have at your business?
Interject for a moment, too. This would be a good time to mention that we do have our own East County Alert Service through East County Magazine, which is a free service. And you can sign up to get those alerts by email or by Twitter on your phone. And that's also helpful. The county is wonderful at pinpointing by zip code. We don't actually do that. But we do alert on a higher number of things. It has to be pretty catastrophic. Mm-hmm. We'll go and tell you that there's a motorcyclist down and, you know, in a blind curve on Highway 79, or that there is, you know, like the other night when there was flooding and 20 cars caught in floodwaters on an exit off of Highway 94. Right. So
yeah,
we can get
the
word
that-
out.
But think also in terms of any community organizations you belong to. One of the things that, for example, when you have like Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts or your churches and you're looking a lot of good people who want to be civically engaged, the things that you can do is you can branch out and you can start working and asking people from the Red Cross to provide training. You can ask, I mean, if you want to volunteer, they can give you mass training, for example, for mass care. So if people are displaced, they need volunteers to help. Yeah. East County, we have to worry about animals. We have to farm animals and pets. You know, we have to make sure that they're taken care of during times of disasters.
Yeah,
they provide this sort of training and they provide other things. So take advantage of pre-existing structures. My church, Christ Lutheran over in La Mesa, yeah, we're doing that exact thing right now. We're developing, how do we make use of the structures we already have?
Yeah, we've actually seen people not evacuate because they didn't have any place to take their animals.
Absolutely.
One of our reporters actually told the firefighters during one of these big fires that, you know, you got 40 people out here in this town that aren't evacuating because they don't have any. They don't want to leave their horses. They're afraid they can't get in. It's a hot day. The horses won't have water. Why don't you open up a shelter that'll take large animals? They said, oh, good idea, these out-of-town firefighters. And they did that.
And one of my grad students, when that happened going back in the early 2000s and the fires we had then, she ended up doing her whole master's thesis on that subject, mm-hmm, of how do you develop an infrastructure for large animals. And so what you see now at the Del Mar Fairgrounds and other places, it's all as a result of a lot of that work. And she was interning with the Office of Emergency Services,
yeah,
at the time. So there's a lot of, you know, overlap in these areas. We don't have to reinvent wheels that are already invented.
Yeah.
And there's lots of good people that really are to just live to teach others how to be self-sufficient and how to volunteer and how to do good things in this area.
And how about planning for your pets so you don't show up at a shelter and found out that they won't take your dog because you don't have the vaccination records or something?
Yeah, and that's another thing. You keep vaccination records of your, you know, the things that we talked about earlier,
yeah,
on the cloud. I mean,
you see, for your cat.
There's an overlap in all these different things we're talking about. And so using the resources of County Emergency Services, mm-hmm, where they literally have the form set up. Do you have pets? Do you have large animals? These are the sort of things,
yeah,
you
so
need to
consider.
Yeah,
so having a carrier, a leash, some extra food, and the vaccination records, maybe all in one box someplace where you can just grab it and go if you have to.
No, absolutely. And things that you don't even think of, you'll find. And so take advantage of those resources and take advantage of the fact that there are many, once again, many good people out there that want to come out and do training for community groups, mm-hmm, that want to teach people how to be. I mean, think about it. You're going to, you know, 36 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours. Can communities take care of themselves?
Yeah, do you have water and some canned food and a can opener?
Generators, things along those lines, you know.
Yeah.
Talk to your neighbors.
Okay, and a portable radio with batteries.
Another thing to think about here, too, is the issue of people who are in rental properties.
Mm-hmm.
We oftentimes don't think of, you know, when I was in university and I was, you know, I lived in an apartment, I never in a million years thought about having rental insurance. You know, I was a starving college kid in grad school and, you know, but the reality is we have so many rental properties here in East County,
mm-hmm,
that we really need to sit and think, well, gee, I'm right here near the San Diego River in a flood zone. I'm right here, yeah, where wildfires can happen. And not putting that little bit of money each month to take care of the contents in your home.
And in your car. I know I found out
car,
I was just,
yeah,
in a bad car accident where my car was totaled, and I found out that my car insurance covers the car, but it doesn't cover what I lost that was in it,
the
like
car.
My camera that was thrown against the,
yeah,
dashboard and shattered.
Yeah,
know?
and these are the sort of things, once again, to be proactive on this, to get fire insurance, if you're making sure you have, nowadays, you pretty much have to if you're in wildfire areas, but things like flood insurance, earthquake insurance, $100 a year, $200 a year,
yeah,
to have that peace of mind to know that you'll be taken care of, because oftentimes these things are not covered by regular,
sure,
insurance.
And clearing your defensible space and documenting what you have. I know during one of the big fires, we interviewed, mm-hmm, somebody who fortunately had enough time before he evacuated that he was able to go through with a video camera and videotape every wall and every room, and he pulled out every drawer and every closet because he knew the house might burn. It did. He was able to get 100%.
Mm-hmm.
On his insurance policies, you know, the max on the policy, and his neighbors were not.
Yeah. I remember my dad coming to me after my house was destroyed. We're having to do that same thing.
Yeah.
Got to sit down. Okay, Jeff, what was all the things you had in your room? What were they?
Who can
try to remember that, right? You know, and honestly, and it's a very difficult thing to do. So keeping that sort of thing up to date, maybe every 6 months, take a good video. Once again, store it on the cloud, you know, put it in a place that, that you know you can pull it down later on.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about students and risks that they should be aware of and avoid. I know we just put a story up about dormitory fires, and I was surprised to learn how many of them start from things like overloading a power bar, for example, or too many things on, you know, one extension cord, a power
the
bar.
The infamous hot plate, you know. So,
as well as drinking-related fires. People get drunk, they fall asleep, they leave the cigarette in the wrong place. But what are some of the risks that students should be most aware of and take precautions?
Well, first off, we have to recognize that all people in college are completely invulnerable to all of life ills, right? so once we get past that concept of hubris, yeah. we recognize that you really do have to. I mean, there are some common sense things, and
yeah.
oftentimes in that era of the age of independence, when we were away from your parents, who are the ones who are supposed to be thinking about it, that oftentimes aren't. Now we're on our own. No, we don't think about that. We don't want to, you know. But typically speaking, most universities, when you have residential programs, they're pretty good at dealing with and talking about these issues on the front ends in terms of all the various things that RAs put together, resident advisors and others. They have different types of outreach type programs. But remember, at the end of the day, you can lead a horse to water, you know, and if students aren't being proactive and thinking about these sort of things, then you see the tragic results that we've seen.
Yeah, exactly. People falling off buildings because they were drunk and standing on the edge or something.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest risks that maybe people are not aware of, that people don't worry about and maybe should, the ones that don't make headlines like earthquakes and fires?
One of the things that I think about in this regard is that it really does – it comes down to the basics of disease, of pathogens and things that can be spread. You know, we're one small mutation away from, you know, H1N1 or something else from having some very dramatic human costs in terms of lives, in terms of health when it comes to disease. I think it's very important that once again, that people pay attention when these things, you hear warnings about things like bird flu, and you hear about words about particularly virulent strain of staph infection or something else, to take all the precautions that the medical experts tell us to take, that the epidemiologists and others tell us to take. We're in a globalized world. We saw with Ebola recently, for example, you know, everybody was freaking out because Ebola might come, and a couple of people did make it here. And, you know, but the reality is that as human beings continue to move from one place to the other faster and faster, we're not going to be able to really keep
right.
a
probably
lid on
the
some
measles
of this stuff.
Outbreak was a bigger risk, right?
But our new plane technologies are such that in the next, you know, within the next decade or two, you will be able to get to Japan within a couple hours, not 10 hours. You're going to be, you know, so the time it takes for the body to incubate disease.
What are some of the changing risks people should be aware of that climate change is bringing? For example, I know that we seem to be seeing a lot more tropical diseases that have never been seen here before, mosquitoes that were never found here before, you know, carrying things like West Nile virus, for example.
Yeah. And I consider myself first and foremost to be a historian. And when I look at climate change, I like looking at the big long-term picture in this. And you do have the rise and fall of empires based upon climate change going back 1,000 years ago, hundreds of years ago, you name it. And what you did see is you saw disease move as a result. The bubonic plague, for example, when you saw the movement of various diseases, and more importantly, even as different populations move, for example, like when you consider the Mongols and what they did in Central Asia and going into India and the subcontinent and the Middle East and into Europe, they were moving because grasslands that they used to keep their horses fed, that they couldn't do so, and they were looking for better pastures.
We're seeing in Alaska now entire villages, they're having to move inland because they're now underwater up there.
I think the notion of hubris that we have right now in the 21st century, that somehow this plot of land that we have will be here forever. I laugh at that when I take my kids and we go 15 minutes into East County and you see all these boulders from glaciers that had previously completely scoured this entire region. It puts it in perspective. But that being said, you know, paying attention to the different changes that, you know, when you do have changes and that bring things like hurricanes, like you mentioned before, or they bring things like the diseases or the other things that can happen.
Or drought. And climate change that increases the risk of wildfire, of course.
No, all these different things that can occur. And that's just part of the cycles of this great Mother Earth. This is a living, breathing organism. And we're going to be facing this. And it's incumbent upon us to try to do the best we can to do proper risk assessments and then to take the appropriate mitigative efforts to prevent these things from having stronger damage than they possibly could otherwise.
You've mentioned some risks that surprise your students for the U.S. overall. Can you give me an example or two?
Yeah. We laugh. I always ask students, how many of you guys are from the state of Washington and the Pacific Northwest? And some of, especially our Navy students who've served up there and they've been in the naval bases, they raise their hand. I said, did you live, you know, west of the five? And they're like, oh yeah. I mean, I said, you would be dead if the Juan de Fuca fault, you know, that's like, because, you know, here you have this incredible fault up there that literally when you read, I mean, it's like completely depressing.
You're talking like 9.0 quake.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. You're talking about like a 30-foot elevation change. You're talking about a massive tsunami. You're talking about a tsunami that also extends back all the way to Japan. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have the historical record and we're long overdue for this. And,
then how about the Yellowstone super volcano?
Oh yeah.
For
super
those
volcano.
Not familiar,
and,
tell us about that.
And Mammoth. Yeah. You know, you guys want to have a hard time sleeping tonight. Go look at the Yellowstone super volcano. And look at how that whole area is just one.
But it's not just Yellowstone. It's
hundreds
of miles, thousands of miles.
I mean, and you have this in the Mammoth Mountain as well. There's some stuff with that. And so, you know, we can spend all day. I mean, once again, the Earth is this living, breathing organism and it's going to do what it wants to do, whether as much as our good intentions and the latest, you know, like I said, Dwayne the Rock Johnson movie or Bruce Willis movie will lead us, you know, the asteroids still hit, you know, and the comets still hit, but there's little we can do in the case of such things. And, you know, we have to just live life the way it is.
I was just going to ask, with so many risks out there, gosh, you live daily with studying about everything from terrorism to tsunamis. How do you avoid just being paranoid about everything?
Always look on the bright side of life, right? My students laugh. I had one of my German students, he said, I finally figured out how to label you, Dr. McElwain, because you don't fit anything. She goes, you're a cynical optimist. And I said, I like that. It's like, you know, being realistic about the world that we live in and the things that we have. At the end of the day, you know, you can't live in fear from these things. You can't live in fear of change or the movement of people. You got to look at the opportunities. And you got to look at the things that we can control. The things we can't control are planes flying from the sky and landing on our house. I'm sorry, we can't do that. I learned that at an early age, and you know, I'm not going to stop flying as a result. And I'm not going to miss out the joys in life that technology can bring to me or to my family and other things. We can't completely get rid of risk. It's just impossible. So in the meantime,
I was once booked on a plane, missed it, and had to reschedule, and it was the PSA midair collision that went down. So it's a little bit of similarity there. You kind of ask yourself, why me? Why was I spared? And yet, you're right. You can't go through life not flying and living in fear.
Yeah. And also, once again, taking stock to build resiliency, build resiliency in our kids, build resiliency in our communities. For example, when Hurricane Katrina hit, I looked at it in a different way than a lot of people. As I was watching the air footage and I was seeing things, what I saw was the Leviathan in the Hobbesian sense, the government. Authority completely removed and humanity was in a petri dish without government there to adjudicate any problems or to rule on things.
You saw the best and worst.
You saw the best and the worst. You saw family members coming together with husbands and wives and others banding together and literally forming tribes out of their community to protect themselves from roving bands of single male predators. I mean, this is anthropology 101. And the thing is, we got to think of in terms of, you know what? We have some great things. We have some great, we have great people, great gifts. We have the ability to be able to think about this ahead of time. And that's the thing that breaks my heart the most is when you see communities hit where people have been told or people have made all this effort to reach communities, to get them prepared, especially the vulnerable populations in our old folks homes and the elderly homes and for disabled people and things along those lines, convalescent homes. These are, I mean, these are the most disadvantaged. Yeah. We have ways of being able to deal with that on the front end, but we need to be active in making sure those things are done.
Paris was another example where we certainly saw the best and worst of humanity, even amid that awful terrorist attack on the theater, where, you know, they were shooting people inside, just gunning them down. And outside, there was some very dramatic footage. Did you see that of a pregnant woman who was dangling from a window ledge and she was shrieking for help? And there was one guy who braved his life to go back inside, sneak upstairs and pull her in through the window.
Yeah. You know, human beings are complex creatures. And, mm-hmm. and I just think on the front end, having studied or worked in and or worked with disaster preparedness for so many years, so much of what we see end up having in terms of tragedy is actually preventable.
Yeah.
And if people just on the front end took a little bit of time out of their busy day to think, to plan, to go to the county website, download that document. I have my students do this all the time.
Mm-hmm. And go take your course.
Download the document. Take my course if you need to, but download the document and your assignment that I give. I give them very practical assignments. Download the thing that says all the things you need to plan for, things you need to have. Then part two of the assignment, do it. Show me you did it.
Yeah.
Okay. Talk about a win-win, right? Easy A.
Really don't.
I mean, I'm a tough professor, right? Go out and do this, you know, buy the batteries or do whatever.
Yeah.
But the point is at the end of the day, people can leave that class knowing that they are in a better position, that they've talked to their family members about it, that they've reached out to that neighbor in the apartment next to them that they might have never talked to before, mm-hmm. but a fire might make necessary one day.
Yeah.
You know, these are the sort of things that we have control over.
So if people want to learn more about your class, is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about that? And then can you tell us where they can get information or sign up for it?
Yeah, a good way of doing this, the university offers Open University, which allows members of our community to come in and take courses in any area at the university, as long as, of course, space limitations allow, that people can take for non-credit, that they can basically sit in to learn. But we've also done something else. We've created a one-unit course that I offer through Extended Studies, which is Intro to Disaster Services. It meets on a Friday for about 6 hours, and then the following Saturday, the next week Saturday, for a few hours. And what we do is we go over the basic disciplines of emergency management. We get a sense of some of the risks that we talked about today in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talk about different ways to mitigate those risks and prepare and do things along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And the students really enjoy it. And it would be great to see the number of people in the community come in, especially people who have, like, you know, you might have professions where you have continuing education, being a part of your licensing and things like that, to be able to see if this can be used maybe to help people in the business community or others who also need resilience in their planning.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in to join us. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Jeffrey McElwain, who is an expert on disaster response and teaches a course on emergency management over at San Diego State's College of Extended Studies. And you can go to sdsu.edu, click on the College of Extended Studies to learn more or sign up. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
St. Michael's Chaldean Catholic Church will host its first annual Gift of Giving Christmas Gala on Friday, December 4th at 8 p.m. The 21 years or older wine and cheese gala will feature a silent auction, raffle items, a selection of wines from local wineries, craft beers, and donated foods. All proceeds from the event will go towards assisting members of our community, said Jennifer Merrim. The majority of it being the Chaldean Catholic and Assyrian refugees who lack basic necessities such as mattresses. We hope that this event will help better support the youth refugee programs and provide them with better opportunities to grow and learn upon first arriving in this country. The event will be held in the church hall at St. Michael's Chaldean Catholic Church on East Washington Avenue in El Cajon. For more information or tickets, visit chaldeanevents@gmail.com. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.